is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
A real big success then doesn't come until the next step of the evolution, where now they take it. Now they start holding each other accountable because they believe it. They were part of the process. And I have to give up some of my control and hand it to them. Say, okay, now it's yours. You take it. You hold each other accountable. If so-and-so is not going hard today, rather than me hold them accountable, you hold them accountable. And that's much more powerful when it comes from within the group.
John Krikorian has been the men's basketball coach at Christopher Newport University since June of 2010. He's just the fourth head coach in the program's 53-year history and has led the captains to amazing success, including its first two Final Four appearances. His squad advanced to the 2015-2016 Final Four in Salem, Virginia, as well as the 2018-2019 Final Four in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He has now guided the captains to the NCAA tournament a total of 6 times, including the last 4 in a row. Krikorian's coaching resume includes 6 seasons as an NCAA Division I assistant and 13 as a Division III head coach. His overall head coaching record is 275-95. Krikorian's journey to CNU began with a passion for basketball from an early age and a tremendous work ethic on the court as an athlete and in the classroom as a student. He earned a bachelor's degree in systems engineering in 1996 from the University of Pennsylvania, where he played on the junior varsity basketball team. Following his college days, Krikorian spent 2 years in the business world working for Princeton Consultants, an information management company in Princeton, New Jersey. In 1998, Krikorian returned to his passion and accepted the position of graduate assistant basketball coach at West Virginia Wesleyan College. After 1 season at West Virginia Wesleyan, Coach K made his first stop at the Merchant Marine Academy as an assistant coach under Billy Lang during the 1999-2000 season. After 1 season there, he returned to his alma mater for 2 seasons, working as an assistant at Penn under Fran Dunphy. Krikorian then accepted an assistant position at another Division I program, Lafayette College in Easton, Pennsylvania. There he assisted Fran O'Hanlon from 2002 to 2004. His journey then took him to Annapolis, Maryland, where he spent 2 years as an assistant at the United States Naval Academy, reuniting with head coach Billy Lang. His time at Navy came to an end when he was named the head coach at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy in 2006, beginning his head coaching journey with an amazing 4-year transformation of the Mariners before becoming the head coach at CNU. After you're done listening to this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes and make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. The Hoopheads Pod can be found on all the major podcast apps. Let a friend or coaching colleague know about the show so we can continue to grow the great game of basketball. You'll want to have your notebook ready as you listen to this episode with John Krikorian from Christopher Newport University in Newport News, Virginia. Let me take a moment to let everyone know about the upcoming BTS Summit in St. Louis on September 27th and 28th. If you haven't heard, BTS is a comprehensive program for running a long-term, profitable, high-quality youth basketball training company. It allows someone to have a career in youth basketball, helping young people become the best they can be both on and off the court. I am honored to have Larry Hughes, 13-year NBA veteran and a co-founder of BTS, here to tell us what this summit is all about. Larry, tell us about the upcoming summit and what it's all about.
Mike, thanks and congratulations on your Hoopheads podcast. We established the summit to provide people interested in building a successful youth basketball program the opportunity to come in for 2 days of learning what we do, how we do it, and how they can apply our system to grow their programs. In March, I opened up our 16,000 square foot facility with leading technology used by several NBA teams, which tracks every shot, every movement on the court, allowing us to objectively assess the progress of our members. People who join the summit will get a chance to use the technology and learn how we integrate it into our programs. We will have David Martin, recently head analytics of the 76ers, speak about direction of technology in basketball. We will also have presentations and workshops on how to effectively build back office systems to create memorable experiences for members and build long-term value in the business. We want to empower the attendees to take their basketball organizations to the next level. So the first 30 signups get to participate for free. Thereafter, it's $199 per person. We have arranged discounted hotels in the area. The event also offers the opportunity to network with others in similar circumstances. We're excited to provide this opportunity to market and think that all attendees will get extraordinary value for attending.
Larry, the summit sounds great. Where can people go to learn more and get signed up?
They can go to basketballtrainingsystems.com/summit to learn more or call us at 301-602-3001.
Thanks, Larry. I'm hoping to make it out to St. Louis myself. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Linsing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Christopher Newport University, John Krikorian. John, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Mike and Jason. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are excited to get the opportunity to talk to you about what you're doing down there at Christopher Newport and also dig a little bit into your backstory and find out what makes you tick as a coach. So let's start by going back to when you were a kid and talk a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball as a kid, what made you fall in love with it, and how that sort of led into you eventually becoming a coach.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in a relatively small town, Auburn, Massachusetts, which is right outside of Worcester. So if you think Holy Cross College was probably the biggest school, and then Boston College down the road, Doug Flutie and all that. I mean, that's there I grew up in. And, you know, I feel like I grew up in just the greatest town you could grow up in. Just great parents, great friends, an extended family that went on for days. And every single day, every weekend, every summer, we were just playing sports. That's just what it was all about. And if we weren't playing, we were watching the Red Sox or or the Celtics or listening to games or just – it was Larry Bird. It was everything. And we would go to the playground with our friends and we would try to be all these guys, you know. And whether it be on the baseball field, if you're infielder, you're Jerry Remy or, you know, if you were a pitcher, you know, and in basketball, we're all trying to be Larry Bird. And we would just go and try to be like these guys. And the love of sport that I had at a young age with all my buddies who I'm still friends with today, you know, like many of us in that era, we just left the house in the morning and we came home at night and we were just playing hoop or football or soccer or baseball, whatever it was that we could do to compete, we were doing it. You know, and I think I was really lucky to have such an extended family with a ton of redheads. And my mother was one of 11 and they all grew up on a farm. And like, if you couldn't hold your own, you're going to spend most of the day in tears. So you had to figure out how to hold your own very quickly. And so that competitive spirit, started at an early age and kind of carried over to everything that I've done and that I'm about in a lot of ways. But my friends, my family, where I grew up, I mean, it absolutely, defines who I am today.
So you and I think grew up in a similar fashion in that I grew up playing all different kinds of sports and not necessarily for my school teams or in any kind of organized fashion, but just playing in the neighborhood, you know, getting a pickup baseball game going or playing some backyard tackle football or playing 2-on-2 basketball in the driveway or whatever it was. I was just always out and always playing and learning how to be competitive. And, you know, we've talked about this before with different guys on the show about just the difference between how kids of today's era grow up, just in general, not necessarily specific to basketball, but just in general, how they grow up and they don't have those same freedoms and opportunities. Like you mentioned, you went out the door at 8:30 or 9 a.m. in the summer and, you know, your mom or dad may or may not have known exactly where you were, but you were running around the neighborhood and playing with, you know, your extended family and your friends and guys that you still are in contact with today. And kids that are growing up today don't have that, you know, don't have that same opportunity. So I think what I heard you say is that type of environment made you more competitive because, again, you had the opportunity to compete against all these people that in your neighborhood, different ages, that, you know, different sizes. And now if you don't compete,
you get left out, you get left behind, or in your words, you know, you're left crying. So maybe compare how you grew up with the way that sort of the youth sports system is today, and just talk a little bit about, in your mind, as now as a college basketball coach, what are some of the pluses and minuses of each of those two ways of growing up, and each in how youth sports is different today than it was when we were kids?
Yeah, that's a great one to tackle. I think it's really relevant to coaching today. First, you know, birth order is actually something that we talk about now as coaching. And being the youngest, having a brother who was 6 years older, right? And most of his friends and then my family were all older. So there was that, again, that survival mentality when you're the youngest. And I think that still translates today when we recruit somebody who's maybe the youngest, who has a lot of family nearby, and they've had to, you know, kind of pay their dues a little bit. You can see it translate, and we will actually look at that a little bit.
That's awesome.
In terms of how we're going to recruit. And, you know, as I was thinking about my childhood, and the one thing that popped out is, you know, I was so lucky because my parents totally supported the competitiveness that I had and my love. So, you know, like, we built a mini Fenway Park in my backyard for wiffle ball. It was unbelievable. I'm just picturing this now. Like, so this is probably, like, you had to figure stuff out, right? Because, like, nobody was doing this for you. Parents were not setting up these games for you. So we had to do everything from getting everybody together on the phone, getting everybody over, who's going to bring this, who's going to bring that, how are we going to get lumber? Like, we literally put posts in the ground. Like, who would let, if my kids now started driving posts in the ground and putting tarps up, we would not be having it, right?
Right.
But we absolutely destroyed my yard. I mean, destroyed it. We had probably very dangerous lights hanging out the window so we could play through the night. And, like, there had to be a fire hazard, you know, like 30 lights in one plug, you know, and we're all trying to get this. And we're playing wiffle ball all hours of the night. I mean, it was just unbelievable. But the lessons that we learned from that, I don't know that many are able to learn in that same fashion today. And that's okay. It's different. And it's fun to reminisce. There's no sense in saying I wish things were the same. It's just an entirely new generation, a lot of ways safer. And, you know, as a parent, we're just not willing to allow our kids to maybe take those risks. Cause we took some risks back then. And so that's part of it, because I think to grow and develop, you have to fail. You have to make mistakes. You have to shed tears. You have to fall and scrape your knee. You have to, you know, have somebody tell you you're no good, and like, you have to go through that, and less that happens today. And so, you know, you don't get as many with just that raw competitive survival spirit, but what you do get are those that, because they love the sport, they've trained and they've been with people that can help them really develop. They probably are much more mature in how they handle failure than I was. You know, I was a really poor sport when I was younger. I mean, it's something that you have to learn as you get older. These kids now, generally, they're such nice kids. I mean, they handle situations in a much more mature fashion than I did at their age. That's a fact. And so, you know, there's it's different. I don't think it's good or bad or better or worse. You know, there are a lot of things I did that were really stupid. And, you know, it could have ended badly.
You could have lost a finger or an eye, right?
Yeah, maybe more supervision might have been good, you know, but it's just what it was. And so, you know, the kids now are different, and there's a lot of positives there. And I think as a coach and someone who's recruiting them, you know, continuing to try to find really what makes them tick inside is the most important thing. All that other stuff, is going to work itself out, who they are on the inside, how they were brought up. I think that's, you got to get to that core. And I don't think the core, if you were a good kid 30 years ago, you're a good kid today. You were brought up right 30 years ago. You're brought up right today. There's a lot of similarities.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's, you know, as somebody who grew up in one era and looks at it in comparison to the era today, I think there's a tendency to feel like the way that you grew up and the system that you came up in is the better system. But I think it's not necessarily better. It's just different. And we all have an affinity for sort of the way we came up in the game. And I know I do. And I feel like the way that I learned the game was the way that I would want to learn it if I had it to do over again. Yet at the same time, I can see the virtues and the value in the system that we have today. So as you were talking, I was kind of thinking about a couple different things. And so I'm going to try to remember both of my questions that I had for you based on what you said. And one of them is, if you look at your time since you started coaching and you look at the average high school player, I think that the average high school player today compared to, let's say, 15 or 20 years ago is more skilled because of what you mentioned in terms of kids going to a trainer or kids getting an opportunity to be exposed to better coaching at an earlier age, where in my era or your era, we were just out playing on the driveway and nobody was necessarily teaching us some of the terminology and some of the footwork and some of those kinds of skills. We weren't necessarily learning those higher level basketball skills. Now, we may have developed our competitiveness. We may have worked by ourselves and been shooting on the driveway or playing more 3-on-3, but we weren't getting that same level of coaching. So in your mind, as a longtime college basketball coach, have you seen, like when you go out and recruit, do you see more kids who are more skilled, like let's say the 10th or 12th man on a high school team? Do you think those kids are better today than they were 15 or 20 years ago?
Yeah, Mike, I don't know. And I've actually heard you talk about this on with some of your other guests. You know, and I would say when it comes to bigger guys or girls, I think it's definitely true. I think, you know, we've gone, you know, a little full circle to where, you know, your forwards now, you know, are not just being thrown inside as much. And they're allowed to go out and dribble, pass, and shoot. So right. I think you are seeing more skill out of the big guys. But I don't know. And I see what you're saying, that, you know, there's more one-on-one training and stuff.
Right,
but,
right.
At the same time, I don't know that the willingness to be uncomfortable is any better today than it was 30 years ago, because you can learn all the new skills you want. But at the end of the day, you're going to have to get out of your comfort zone to make those skills a reality and to put them into action, which they don't have nearly enough time to do. So there's some guys, they can dribble 95,000 times through their legs.
Right.
Okay. And then as soon as someone breathes on them in a game, they turn it over. So, you know, I think there's a balance there of, I think the one thing we were really good at back in the day is being uncomfortable. And the guys that did, like, there, you worked out with guys, right?
Right. Absolutely.
Like I worked out with guys. We didn't always just play 5-on-5, but the workouts like had a level of intensity and uncomfortability that was really made a difference. You know, and today there's some of that. There's probably just as much of that. There's also a lot of training that's going on that I see that to me is, I don't want to say a waste of time, but I don't know how beneficial it is to the player, to being a better basketball player.
Right. In other words, does what you're doing translate to actual gameplay? And I think in that case, you're 100% right in that what it takes to be able to be successful in a drill by yourself with some cones or working out one-on-one with another player who in all likelihood is probably your same age and your same skill level doesn't translate the same way it does to being a 14-year-old kid and playing against somebody who's 25 years old and an adult and is pushing you around and maybe knows all the little tricks of the trade that a 14-year-old might not know. And you got to figure out a way to make that work. And I think that's something that I think is a challenge for anybody who's out there who is doing any kind of training or that. I think the good ones are always looking for how can I make the skills that I teach more transferable to games so there's actual results that are being shown by the player as opposed to, as you described, like, yeah, I can dribble between my legs 95,000 times and I can make all these moves, but how often in a game do I actually have to do that? What I'd really like to see my players be able to do is just catch and shoot a high percentage as opposed to, you know, all these different things that they may never even get a chance to do in a game.
Yeah, well, and right, and so the other part of that is you talk about the fundamentals, right? The fundamentals of a pivot or a proper pass with good ball rotation or a shot that's one-handed instead of two-handed. And, like, these are very – in order to get good at these things, it's very mundane. It's not exciting. Like, you just got to do it over and over and over again, you know? And, again, I think that's something that long ago that we didn't have nearly as many distractions. So if a coach said, hey, pivot for an hour, you pivoted for an hour. You just did it.
Right. Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And now, you know, we have to keep it everything on the move so much, and we have to keep people's attention that – sometimes we move on too quickly to the next thing before we've planted the fundamentals. Not in all cases. And again, I'm not saying everything was so much better then than it is now, but, you know, I just wanted to kind of counter your point that they're just more skilled today. I don't know that across the board I can say that, but, and I do think it's a great balance. And this, I've been fortunate to work for some great coaches, and specifically in Division I in college, Billy Lang, who's at St. Joe's now, Fran O'Hanlon at Lafayette, and Fran Dunphy at Penn. And, like, Fran Dunphy, who's, I mean, just legendary, Big Five Hall of Fame coach and player, he was a get-it-done guy. So, you know, you could do all this training. At the end of the day, in the game, when it's 5-on-5, are you getting it done? Do you know how to play with your teammates, and are you getting it done? And he was an old school guy in that way. And there's a lot of value to that. And then, but by the same token, in Fran O'Hanlon, you had a guy that, and he's still coaching at Lafayette and still doing amazing things there. His level of detail and all the nuances of the game, footwork and hand placement and spacing on the court, it just was beyond. I still can't understand the stuff that he taught me. But when you marry those two, to me, that's the exciting part of coaching, is getting some guys that are willing to do what they got to take to get it done, but at the same time are willing to get out of their comfort zone and learn some of these nuances, which can help them kind of get an edge. And, you know, I was very lucky to be around those guys, and Billy Lang as well, who's got great attention to detail, as well as a great competitive passion. And he does a great job combining the two. I mean, I've been fortunate to have those three as mentors. And so I don't know if it's new school, old school, or what. I think it's, what's great about our game, it's constantly in flux and changing, and it's in evolution, and you got to try to stay a step ahead.
Yeah, and I think to piggyback off that, it still comes down to really what I hear you saying is two things. It comes down to, can you master the fundamentals of the game, which can be boring, which can be mundane, and you can define the fundamentals however you want to define them, and you can talk about levels of nuance and how far you want to break that down. But the bottom line is the best players at any level of basketball, from fourth grade up to the NBA, the best players at any of those levels in all likelihood are the kids, the players that have put in the time to be able to master the fundamentals. And then the second piece of that is, are they competitive, and does it translate to them being able to play and perform the skills and the fundamentals that they have? Can they perform those in a game under game pressure at game speed? And I think when you combine those two things, then you found the kind of player that as a coach, you know, you want to have those are the types of players you want to have on your team. And I've said this to people, you know, I'll go watch a high school game between two teams I've never seen before. And, you know, you go and you sit down in the stands and, you know, you watch for 5 minutes and somebody who has experience watching games, you could tell right away within 5 minutes of who the kids are that are basketball players. There's a lot of guys out there playing basketball, but there are very relatively few players who are basketball players. And I think what you just described is the formula for how we create basketball players as opposed to just kids who are playing basketball, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, I just rambled on for 10 minutes and you summarized it in like 30 seconds. So like that's all right, that's why you're right.
I'm doing something right at this end. So
that's why you're the professional podcaster and you should just cut me out, post that, and people probably listen.
I like it. We got to get into the nitty gritty for sure. we're all good. All right, I want to ask you. I want to go back to one of the things that while you were talking about your competitive nature when you were a kid and just about how intense and how important it was for you to compete and to want to win. And if you didn't get a chance to do that, that you might be sitting over on the side and crying. And I think about, as you were saying that, I was picturing myself as a 14 to 22 year old and the way that my competitive nature came out. And one of the things that I've always said is that if I had to compare whether I hate to lose or I love to win, I mean, I love to win, but even more than that, I hate to lose. And I can remember a lot of times being after a game where we lost and I didn't want to talk to anybody, or I was in tears, or I was embarrassed to show up at the school the next day because we had lost the night before. And I get the sense just from hearing you talk that you sort of had that same mentality of just you can't stand losing. And then you also mentioned in that same vein that, you know, kids today, because they grow up under a different system, that maybe that same level of competitiveness or that same level of hating to lose maybe isn't there in every kid. So as a coach, how do you deal with the kid who, like, okay, I lose and it maybe outwardly doesn't seem like it's quite as important to them. They're not as demonstrative in their distaste of losing, for lack of a better word, a way of saying it. I know that was one of the things when I was in coaching that it took me a long time to get adjusted to the fact that kids could lose a game and then get on the bus 15 minutes later and just kind of be chatting, like, you know, and they're able to move on much quicker. So talk a little bit about that from your perspective as a competitive guy.
There's a lot to that. That's a loaded question. I mean, I was that guy, right? And I hated to lose. And I don't know that I loved basketball any more than I loved baseball or anything that I did. Like, we could have made up a game in a yard with two sticks, right? Like, it didn't matter. My drive was
to compete,
as you said, to not lose. Like, I had to get the upper hand, and we were allowed to kind of do that. I don't know that it always led to the healthiest decisions, right? Honestly.
Yeah, agreed. I'm not sure me crying for 15 minutes after a game being upset for the next 24 hours was really healthy for my mental health. Right.
I don't know how productive that was to not sleep and to stew over, you know, a poor performance or, you know, even worse, you know, behaviorally and acting out or whatever, like, but that's what we were that was accepted then, you know, like you could just act that way. And I did, I was insanely competitive. And for the most part, I was able to kind of get away with it. And that drove me to be, you know, successful enough in all the sports that I played that I could just kind of will my way through, you know, like I wasn't some great soccer player, but I'll just, you know, like I'm just going to run you over.
Right, exactly. And
maybe get by and like just do what I needed to do to get the ball in the net or in basketball. I was no great basketball player, trust me, you know, but I was just willing to compete a little bit harder. But as I got into coaching, I found that as much as I loved guys that were like that and like me, there's a ceiling to that too. That you can only compete your way in this great game of basketball or in any great game to a certain level. Then at some level, you're going to have to really understand the game and the nuances, and it goes beyond the competitiveness. And so I've really tried to strike a balance with my teams of having guys that are super competitive, that want to win every drill in practice. But I also know if I have 15 guys like that, we're probably going to win some games. But I don't think we can win all of our games. I don't think that we can win a national championship. I think we need to then complement that level of competitiveness with guys that are maybe cerebral players, that really understand the game, that make other people better, that make it seem effortless, that, you know, maybe they don't outwardly show emotion. Maybe they keep that inside, or maybe they just can handle, you know, failure better than the rest of us. And they still want to win, but they don't have to go and run around cursing and kicking things and, you know, putting on a show.
Right.
They can just handle it in a much different fashion. And guys like you and me, we need those guys on our team.
Right. Right.
Right. And so I found that the better teams we have, the more we have a balance of cerebral players, mature players, raw competitive players, with a mix of diversity and talents and backgrounds, and we can all lift each other up. And I've also found that the greatest competitors, if you were to study it, which I have, what they have in common that I don't with them, and they make it look easy. Tom Brady makes it look easy. Michael Jordan made it look easy. They're not running around grunting and sweating and losing their cool and kicking helmet. Like, and so that's the sweet spot, I think, as a coach now that's trying to achieve at the highest level and help my teams do the same. That as much as I'm proud of my background and who I am, I don't need to have a team full of guys like me.
Do you think you came to that realization slowly over time? Is that something that you've evolved your thinking on that from when you first started coaching, where maybe you thought that, hey, initially, man, I got to have super competitive guys. And then over time, as you gain more experience, you realized, hey, I got to have a bigger balance, or did you figure that out pretty quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you learn from your players. I mean, I think if we'll say if you're good, but like if you're a leader, all right, it's about understanding the people that you lead and being open to learning from them. And so, you know, after a few years of coaching and being around players and initially looking at a player and going, man, that guy, he it doesn't even look like he cares. But then watching the way he carries himself and lifts up the team in different ways, and then you start to see, hey, there's a lot of value to what that player brings. And then early on as a head coach, I wanted to establish a culture that was like me, right? That's all I knew.
Right.
So just, I want competitive guys, and we're just going to outwork people and out tough people. And we did it, you know, like that Merchant Marine team, those teams I had there, they were tough, competitive, and we achieved a great deal there. But then at the end of the day, I still had to look and say, well, could we have done more? Is there another level we can get to? When I came to Christopher Newport, we started off the same way. We got to just be tough, competitive. We got to be, and we did well. But then, you know, like success is like a drug, right? You want to do better than what you've done. So it's like, how could we get to the next level? Who are we losing to in the NCAA tournament first round? Who are we losing to in the conference championships? Who are we losing to? There's 16 more teams advancing. We're not. Why? And they all looked like they were having way more fun than us when they played. And they all made it look easy. Like, the teams that were really, really good, like, they, you know, we're killing ourselves over here for every loose ball. You know, everyone's on the ground, and they're over there, you know, just bopping around.
Just playing.
Knocking down
threes, right.
Playing.
Yep.
And so, you know, I think just over time, just trying to raise the bar. We have a very competitive spirit within our program, but we've been able to kind of add and complement that, you know, with maybe more diverse players that maybe I wouldn't have recruited 10 years ago. And it's made all the difference.
Yeah. What I hear you saying is that, one, there's some adaptability there, that if you're a coach, you have to be willing to be reflective on yourself and be self-aware of what you're doing, why you're doing it, and then the results that you're getting. And you go back and you do that self-analysis, and now you can figure out, hey, I got to do something a little bit different to take us in that next step. And I think great coaches and great leaders and people who are successful in any walk of life, I think that's one of the common traits that the people that I know that have been successful, that they share, is that they're always self-examining and looking at what they do and looking at how they do things and trying to figure out a way that, even if they are successful, they're always looking for a way to take it one step further. How can I get just a little bit better? And that's kind of what I hear you saying. Do you think that's an accurate description of kind of what you've done there at Christopher Newport?
Again, you did that in 10 seconds after I just ramble. But no, you're absolutely right. And to add to that, or at least in my case, I couldn't do it myself. You know, so sometimes you need to lean on other people or bring mentors in or get out of your comfort zone, because, you know, when I get on this train of coaching, like, you're just going, right? And for me, you know, a big key was I went back to school. I went to VCU's Center for Sport Leadership, which has been an amazing experience for me. I got my degree in sports leadership. I actually now teach as an adjunct in the program. So it's been part of my life here now for about 6 years. And when I first got in, the first class I took on leadership forced me to sit down and write and reflect on why I coach, the way I do. And that was in conjunction with a book by Joe Ehrman called Inside Out Coaching, which is...
That's a great book. That book's
right?
Fantastic, yeah.
Right. And so at that time, to read that book and then to reflect on why I was coaching the way I did, you know, it really kind of, some things started to click. And I was like, man, wow, I never really thought about this. I just did it. You know, I never took a class in coaching in my life. I just did it. I just did it based on my experience working for other guys and my experience as a player. I never really thought about what I was doing other than the strategy. I just did it. And so that for me was, I think, a major turning point. I don't know if I would have been able to really kind of turn the corner as much as I have without it. And so sometimes you got to, you know, look outside the box.
Head Start Basketball's Cutthroat Game Building Program debuts on Tuesday nights in September. Players in grades 5 through 10, both boys and girls, you won't want to miss this one. Registration is open now at www.headstartbasketball.com.
Why'd you want to become a coach in the first place? What was it about coaching when you decided, hey, this is the direction that I want to go with my career? Was it just, hey, it's the sports background, I want to continue to be in sports, coach is the role that, you know, that I see? Or was it something deeper than that at the beginning? Obviously, now you've gotten to a much deeper point in what your philosophy is and what your mission is. But when you think back to when you first decided to go into coaching, what did your why look like then, maybe compared to what it looks like now?
Yeah, it's always been two things, and I think it's the same today. And I think there was a period there where I may have lost my way, but just I always thought, like, I love sports. Competitive as the day is long. I'm going to need to have this in my life. Whatever I do, whatever I do is going to be affiliated in some way with my love of sport and competition. I knew that from day one. But what I didn't know, like, coming in up through high school in this small town, was that, like, that could actually be a living. You know, like, I didn't necessarily aspire to be a teacher per se, and my dad was, but I didn't necessarily aspire to just be like a high school teacher and coach on the side. I didn't know the industry. I didn't know that there was opportunities to actually make a living coaching, right? I didn't know any of that stuff.
Right.
I just knew I had to do something, you know? So, you know, and I also knew that I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to impact other people in a positive way. And through sport, obviously, it's a great way to do that, because a lot of people love sports. So those are two things that I've always had from day one. And I went to Penn, ironically, I went to Penn thinking I was going to play baseball. And I ended up getting hurt and walking on to the JV basketball team after a year had gone by. So, like, incredibly ironic. So I walk on to the JV basketball team. But one of my first basketball experiences at Penn was at the Palestra, which is
there's not a much better place to be able to play some college basketball games than that, and then the Palestra.
It's the cathedral of college basketball, and I didn't know much about it. I was from Massachusetts, you know, like, I didn't grow up in Philly. Like, all my buddies were like, oh, the Palestra. I was like, what are you talking about? You know,
some old gym, right?
Yeah, whatever. And I go, in my first game I go to, I'm not affiliated with the team, I'm not a player, I'm not anything, I'm just a student. And they're playing UVA. Jeff Jones was the coach. They were really good. Penn was good. Close game. Sold out Palestra. And I was sitting there like, this is unreal. You know, like, I got to do this. I got to do something to do with this. I'm going to find a way to make that happen. So, you know, I just ended up playing pickup ball all the time when I was at Penn. The pickup basketball at Penn in that era was just awesome. There was just... you and I spoke earlier about it. Another JV guy you had on your podcast. I think about a guy, Seth Berger, who started the company And One. He played pickup ball with us as a student at Penn. That's where he started it. One of my teammates was the guy.
Is that we got the mixed tour?
The whole mixtape. Yeah, exactly.
That all started at Gimbel Gymnasium where we played pickup ball at Penn.
Amazing.
Like, so I'm just some dude who's in there playing, and I get to know some of the guys because I play so much, and I end up making this JV team. And, you know, then it started to, like, become a little bit of a reality. Like, wow, like, I could, you know, maybe work some camps and get into this coaching thing. And, you know, and then it kind of took off from there, just my affiliation with Penn. And Coach Donahue, who's the head coach at Penn now, was my JV coach. And he was hugely instrumental in helping me kind of, you know, hey, well, you know, how do I do this? And he helped me get started in a lot of ways. Coach Duffy was a great mentor for me. And, you know, it just happened.
Your last year, you were a student assistant, correct?
Right. So I played my sophomore and junior year. And then I was like, all right, if I'm not going to make varsity as a senior, again, my playing career was not exciting. All right. So I knew my ticket was not going to be as a player. It was going to be as a coach. And so my senior year, I approached him. I'll never forget. I walked into Coach Duffy's office, sat down, said, Coach, is there any chance that I can play on the varsity team this year? And he looked at me and said, you know, hey, Coach John, I wish you were a little, you know, if everyone had your heart, you know, like the Rudy speech. I was like,
right,
okay,
exactly.
I got you. I'll cut you off right there. Can I help you, coach? Can I do something? And he said, oh, yeah, you know, why don't you do this set? And they let me travel and do all sorts of stuff. And I just got hooked.
What was the most eye-opening piece of becoming a coach on the staff in a program you had kind of been a part of as a player? Because I would think that there were a lot of things that went on behind the scenes with the coaching staff that when you were on the playing side of it that you weren't aware of, you didn't even think about. So when you think back to that time, what are one or two things maybe that you remember that you were surprised that the coaches had to do or had to handle that as a player you would have never thought of?
Yeah, I just think the speed, again, like I was not the most cerebral player, right? We've talked about this. I was a grinder, head down, will my way. So like this, when you step over to the coaching side early on, like the speed of the game and trying to see everything that was going on, when you really like the, initially you're just following the ball. And, you know, I'll never forget being my senior year and I'm, you know, this student assistant coach and I'm in charge of fouls and timeouts. Like it's got to be like the easiest job you can have. Just keep track of the fouls and the timeouts. Right. I was an engineer. Okay. I'm a systems engineer at Penn. All right. I'm going to graduate with that degree. So like, I'm not a dumb guy. But here I am on the sideline trying to keep the most basic sheet, fouls and timeouts, okay? And I'm like, my head's going side to side watching the ball go up and down. And like, I'm totally screwing up. I can't even keep it, you know? And at one point, you know, someone hollers down like, hey, how many fouls or whatever? I'm like, crap, I don't have any idea what's going on right now.
It's a panic, right? Hey, now you know how these AAU parents feel. They'll have to come in and work the scoreboard or work the score sheet in an AAU tournament. They've never done it before.
I'm just, you know, so I lied my tail. I was like, yeah, three. We got, you know, three. I'm looking down. I'm like, God, I hope I got that right, you know.
That's fun.
So, no, just the speed and getting to really understand the game. I didn't really have an appreciation for the game of basketball as a game. And the love I have for the purity of the sport that I do now until I was coaching for several years.
So describe sort of the transition, like you mentioned that, you know, when you first got into it, that you're watching the ball. So you're watching the game like a fan who's sitting on their couch is watching a game. You're not watching it like a coach. So how do you transition, or how do you remember that transition for yourself going from where you were just kind of watching the game as a former player and a fan, and you're following the ball to where you're really watching the game as a coach, and you're seeing, you know, you start to see different actions that are taking place away from the ball, and you're starting to really think about how coaching actually works. Describe a little bit about that process of learning how that went and how that, you know, how that transpired for you.
I think the number one, I'm not done with that process.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like I still, you know, I'll watch the film after a game and how the heck did I miss that? Like, well, you know, so it's an ongoing process, and there are so many guys that are so much better than me. And it's just a matter of, you know, the more you do it, as long as you're doing it intentionally, the better you're going to get at it. And so like these guys in the NBA right now, and this is why, you know, some of these NBA head coaches now, you're looking at their track and you're like, well, this dude didn't even like coach anything. He was a video guy.
Right. Exactly.
But those, think about it, those guys are getting an advanced degree in basketball.
For sure.
With as many games as they play and how much video they watch. And, you know, so for me, when it went from me being like a real novice to really understanding the game better was, as a Division I assistant, when I was scouting, you know, and when you're really breaking down film and you learn so much from your opponents. So, you know, you're breaking down the Princeton offense because you're scouting the game. And now you're starting to understand the nuances and hear the calls. And then, you know, maybe someone else is running the flex offense and someone else is running five out offense and someone else is running blocker cutter. And you're responsible for scouting. And so you're watching, you know, however many films back to back to back on these teams. And for me, that's when my knowledge, really started to increase at a greater rate.
Yeah, it's interesting. I tell people this story of my first year coaching. I was a JV basketball coach my first year out of school. And I remember going into my first practice with 12 kids. And I love what you said about, the speed of the game and then just how it eventually started to slow down for you as you watch more. But that first practice, I remember running my first drill and watching it and being like, after 5 minutes, being like, I have no idea how to even correct all the stuff I'm seeing and I'm watching. I'm like, there was just 500 things that went wrong and I want to try to fix, every single one of them. And I just remember being completely overwhelmed as a 23-year-old guy trying to figure out how do I coach? I thought, hey, I played at a high level. I know what I'm doing. I know the game. And yet coaching is a completely different animal from, from the playing side of it. And obviously there's, there's things that are transferable, but at the same time, just because you were a good player, as I found out very, very quickly, doesn't make you a good coach. You really have to evolve and learn and change the way that you approach the game of basketball. I think from a coaching standpoint, it's completely different from, a playing standpoint for sure. So let's flip it to where we are now with your current job now. How much, because we were talking about film, how much film do you yourself watch, or how much film do your assistants watch on a, for one opponent, let's say, how much film are you watching to get prepared for that game, or how much film are you watching in a week?
Yeah, I'm a film junkie. So like I love it. And if there's one thing that I've never really been able to give up as a head coach, and I have had great assistants, I've had multiple guys go on who are now sitting on Division I benches as assistants. I mean, I have had top of the line assistants, and they do a lot of the scouting and they watch the film and they break it down, but I still haven't given that up. So I still scout every opponent and I watch as much film as I can on every single opponent. And now, you have Synergy and you have these software programs that break it down by, every single way you want to know, what a guy had for breakfast before he played an away game on a Wednesday night, how he performed versus on a Tuesday. You can get that information. You can break it down, but you still got to watch the game and try to find things that are going to help you and your schemes be successful. And to me, that's still my favorite part. Once obviously you have a team of guys where you have a good culture and we're all in it for the right reasons. And it all starts there. The X's and O's aren't even relevant if you don't have your culture, but we do now. And once you do, the next most exciting thing for me is, all right, how can I give them just a little edge? What is the edge I can give them going into this game from a scouting standpoint? And I mean, we'll watch it. We'll break it down there any which way. We'll chart stuff on, an old yellow notepad. We'll go through every single clip for three games. And, my assistant coach is like, what are you doing? Like, you get all these pages of notes and everything. It's like just trying to find some patterns or some strategy. And it's just, I really enjoy it, So, you put the kids to bed, everyone goes to bed, and you're sitting here on the couch, and it's 10 o'clock at night, and I'll just go until I fall asleep. Like, I just love it. It's one of the parts of coaching that I really enjoy is trying to figure out other teams. And, there's so many good coaches out there. There's so much to learn at the same time too. So you're not only helping your team get ready, but you're also growing as a coach.
Absolutely.
It sounds like Mike with doing podcasting until he falls asleep in the office chair.
Putting together episodes.
It's putting the episodes together.
Putting the episode together. I've yet to fall asleep while we're recording, but I have fallen asleep while I'm trying to put together episodes for sure. So what's one or two things when you sit down and you're going to watch a film, what are one or two things that are for lack of a better way of saying it, non-negotiable things that you want to pull out from that film? What are some key things that when you're looking at an opponent, you say, I have to figure out this about that opponent so that I can prepare my team for it? Is there a general pattern of things that you look for? Obviously, each individual opponent and scheme and things that they do are all different, but is there a common theme to kind of what you're looking for as you watch a film?
Yeah, no, I hate to just flat out say not no, but I'm kind of going to say that. Like, I think that's what I enjoy the most. Like, every game is a completely unique entity. All right. And so, like, what I'm trying to do is I'm just trying to figure out what they do every day. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yep.
What, by watching them play, I should be able to determine the drills that they do on a daily basis. And if I can figure out what's important to them and what they do every day, then maybe I'll have a chance of trying to force them to do something that they don't do every day. And then if they beat us in that way, then we'll shake their hand, say, hey, you know, they're, you know, that's a multiple dilemma. But if and it's not always easy, but if we can figure out, hey, clearly they must do a drill every day where they go from here to here, boom, 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 you know, and they dribble out this wing and he back cuts because they did it 30 times in this game. And so they do this every day. So, all right, that's the number one thing that they're good at. Can we take that away or can't we? We might not be able to. And then if not, okay, then how are we going to counteract that? So in some teams, that might be a scheme on offense. In some teams, it might be their pressure defense. In some teams, it might be a singular player. So, you know, first you got to figure out, like, I think what the strength of the team is. And that could be a lot of different things. And then trying to determine, you know, really what they hang their hat on and what they do every day, and then see if there's anything we can do to take that away. But it's like, to me, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. And when you do it long enough and you study the film long enough and you get with your assistant coaches long enough and you're, you know, like, you hope you get to a point where you all look at each other and, you know, the light comes on and you go, okay, hey, you know, within what we do, we got a chance here because we can do this. And sometimes you go, I'm not sure there's anything we can do.
I'm not sure we can deal with that.
We're just going to have to be better at what we do in this game than they are at what they do. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, it's much more of an art than a science. It's a puzzle. And, you know, that's some part of it I really enjoy. But, no, there's not like a, you know, every notepad.
Game, every game's its own entity.
Every notepad looks completely different. It's got different columns on it and different lines and different headings. It's totally different than the last.
That's very cool, and I'm sure it keeps you on your toes because every single opponent that you're looking at, obviously everybody's running different systems and doing different things. And, you know, as you said, I think describing it as a jigsaw puzzle is a good way to describe it. Once you get done doing all that, how much of that film do you share directly with the player? So how much are your kids watching with you together as a team? Obviously, they have access, I'm sure, to as much film as they want to watch, whether it's, you know, on their phone or iPad or whatever. But how much film do you guys watch together as an entire team, coaching staff and players together?
Yeah, not a lot. We will tend to watch more film of ourselves in the preseason. You know, that first 4 weeks of the season when we can practice but we don't play yet. That's when I think we learn a lot about ourselves and they can see themselves. When it comes to the scouting, it'll be very deliberate. And I don't want to overload them with too much information. I want my coaches and I to have all the information, but I want the players not to be paralyzed by having too much information. I want them to only have as much as they can put into action. Sometimes you have to make tough choices. Like, hey, we know this and this and this are going to happen, but that is too much for our guys to be able to process and still play at a high level of speed. So we're only going to give them this for now. And maybe we'll have this as an adjustment and we'll hold it in the bag. But like, so I think that's important too. So we try not to give them too much. Now, as my teams get mature and older and I have juniors and seniors, now what you find is they start taking on the lead and they, you know, we'll post a couple games of our opponents prior, but we don't make them watch it or anything. But as they get older and more mature, now you'll have guys coming in. Hey, coach, I watched, you know, their last two games. Like, well, you know, what are we going to do about this? You know, hey, coach, what do you think? Should we do this in this game like we did the last game? You know, and that's when I think a program really starts to separate itself, when that's coming from the players. And we've started to have that over the last few years. And that's been a huge part of our success, I think, is the ownership, the empowerment, and the leadership of our players.
All right. That's a great way for us to jump back to something that you said earlier, which was, you know, the X's and O pieces of the game is obviously something that you love, but the X's and O's without the culture piece don't necessarily mean anything. And so what I hear you saying there in that particular answer is our guys are starting to figure out what our program is all about. And now not only are we as the coaching staff passing that culture on and taking and investing in it, but now your kids are investing in that culture and they see, hey, if we want to be successful, we're taking ownership and we're watching the film. We're coming in with ideas and we're having these questions and conversations. So when you think back to when you first got the opportunity to get to Christopher Newport and you're a head coach, how do you go about building the type of culture that you have in place now? And I already can hear your answer, which is going to be that it's continuing to be a work in progress. But if you think about where you were when you started to where you are now, what were some of the concrete steps that you took to start to build the type of culture that you knew you wanted to have as you were moving forward?
Yeah, I think building a program or a team or a business, you know, or, you know, any group of people, I really believe, like we talked about it earlier, it starts with your why, right? Like, are we all on the same page with why we're here? Number one, do I as the leader have a very clear understanding of why I'm here, why I'm doing what I'm doing? It's got to be bigger than wins and losses. It has to be. And then when you come into a program, you know, it's about your people. Now, some people you inherit, and so you have to help them to understand your why and to understand their why and to try to bring them all on the same page. But while you're doing that, you're recruiting in and bringing in coaches and players that are coming in the door understanding what we're doing and why we're doing it and what it's all about. And once you get a team full of people and coaches and staff that are all on the same page, and they all can look at each other and say, hey, this is what we want to do. We want to make a great impact. We want to be the best team we can be. We want to be out there in the community. And we want to have great relationships with each other, regardless of whether we win or we lose. You know, we want to be brothers. We want to do something really special here. Once we start talking in that language, then it becomes, okay, this is what we said we want. Now, I, as the leader, have to hold them accountable. You know, and so this is early on in the process at Christopher Newport is now, you know, it's the accountability piece, the level that we need to work, the accountability of being on time, the accountability of work ethic, the accountability in the weight room, you know, all the little things that I know that it takes and we've all agreed that it takes. Now, I, as a leader, have to be the one to hold everybody accountable. So that this evolution now is going. And so now, you know, we're having some success. But our real big success then doesn't come until the next step of the evolution, where now they take it. Now they start holding each other accountable because they believe it. They were part of the process. And I have to give up some of my control and hand it to them. Say, okay, now it's yours. You take it. You hold each other accountable. If so-and-so is not going hard today, rather than me hold them accountable, you hold them accountable. And that's much more powerful when it comes from within the group. And so then this is all part of this evolution now to where, like, we're kind of near a pinnacle point where we have self-accountability. We have a culture where, you know, there's an extreme level of learning and risk-taking where they're not afraid to fail. They just want to continue to move forward and play the toughest teams that we can and challenge each other in practice as much as we can, because they understand the process is that when you fail, that's how you get better. Not that when you fail, you failed. And this is, again, all part of this evolution. And I think the final piece of the puzzle, and I think this is what we're trying to attain, and this is where the best, like the New England Patriots, right? I'm a New England guy. They understand performance on the big stage at the elite level, and like this emotional intelligence and performance that is elite, because at the end of the day, you have a great culture, you have great training, you have a competent strategy or even an elite strategy. But when the ball gets tipped, you still got to be able to perform when the lights are on the biggest stage. And that's another level that we're still trying to get to. And there's a lot to that. There's a lot on performance. There's a lot of great people out there that speak on performance and lead teams and all that. And I think that's the next step for us. But, you know, things like deep breathing and mindfulness and visualizations and understanding the stress, kind of stress performance curve and some of these things, you know, I think we've moved the needle forward. And, you know, I think in a culture, I'm kind of rambling here, but I think that's the final piece of the puzzle. You know, I think it's having great people, holding them accountable, letting them hold each other accountable, and then helping them perform at their very, very best on game day.
All right, so I want to follow up with two questions here. And I'm going to first go back one step to accountability, and then we'll move back to that performing at their best on the big stage. So from an accountability standpoint, how do you, as the head coach, go about teaching your kids how to hold each other accountable? Because in my experience, both as a player and as a coach, that's one of the most difficult things to have players do, is teach them how to hold each other accountable without it becoming, I'm blaming you, or I'm putting you down, or I'm saying something to you. How do you get that? How do you build that trust so that they can hold each other accountable without having it damage the relationship between players? I don't know if that question makes sense, but again, how do you teach that holding each other accountable piece of it? Is there anything that you can point to that you do, or is it more just you modeling how that works?
No, well, you said the magic word, it's trust, right? And so it's kind of our job as leaders to promote an environment that is built on trust rather than built on fear, which is that's the old school way, right?
Right.
But if we can build it where it's based on trust, where it's that we're having very intentional conversations about this is what we all want, right? This is what we all want to do. All right. And let's flush that out. Okay. So, you know, you, Billy, tell me what this means. Why are we here? Why are we doing what we're doing? Flush it out. Okay. And then, all right, Joe, what do you think about that? All right. Are we, and you really flush it out in some conversation until, you know, you get it. Everybody looks around the room and like, hey, everybody in the room cares. Everybody wants to win. Everybody wants to be successful. Everybody wants to make a difference. We're all in this together, understanding we're all going to make mistakes, and understanding that conflict not only is good, it's necessary. Failure is not only good, it's necessary. And having those conversations, hey, tell me about a time when you failed and it made you better. And let that player flush that out. Let the players talk. And you'll find they, as they become more vulnerable in that way, as they flush it out a little bit, now you start to build that trust. And then in practice, when there's a situation that occurs, somebody doesn't hold someone else accountable, you as a coach are willing to stop practice and take it seriously enough that you're going to use that time, valuable time, right? You only get 2 hours on the court.
Right.
To say, hey, why didn't you say something there? You saw him run into the screen. Okay. You know that that's going to hurt our team and our defense, but you chose to say nothing. Why? Why not? And maybe, you know, you got to, and then when it does happen, yeah, and these are young guys, right? In the prime of their lives, like, you know, then you risk, you get to the point where now they want to like throw down and fight or something, right?
Right.
You know, but getting them to understand that no, conflict is necessary. It's not personal. If I hold you accountable, I'm trying to make you better. It's not personal. And to encourage it and to talk about it and to like, we call in our practice, we call it fireworks. So whenever there's some confrontation or conflict or peer-to-peer accountability going on in practice and it gets a little heated, you know, we'll just, you know, we'll let it go. And then when the time comes to talk about, hey, we had some fireworks. It's good stuff. We need fireworks. We need more fireworks.
Yep.
You know, and but when you walk off that court into the locker room, it's over. Like, it's done. It's not personal. No one's carrying it. Like, when we're in the heat of battle, you can't be sensitive. You know, you can't worry about the way the message was sent. You got to just be ready to go. And listen, it's a process. It's not easy. I mean, I'm not writing any books on this stuff. I mean, there's people that are way smarter than me that have this all figured out. But like, I do think that the players are going to do what you emphasize every day. And you have to choose early. Are you going to choose your culture or are you going to choose some results-based shooting drill? And as a coach, you only have 2 hours. You got to make that choice. And I think for those that choose culture, that's what the players are going to follow. If you choose accountability, it's what they're going to follow. We'll have high school guys that, you know, they'll come to a practice. Man, you guys really talk. How do you get them to talk? Well, I make them.
Right.
You hold them accountable. How dare you?
We emphasize it's important, you know, and a lot of people give up on it because it's hard. But if you think it's important and you emphasize it and you empower those that do it well and you encourage them to do it more, they want to please. Yeah, they want to be good. They want to play. And they'll do it, but it's not easy. And I think it's a similar deal. Like, it's not a black and white thing, but they are going to try to follow and do what you emphasize every day. And I think that's one of them.
I think that's a great description of what accountability is all about. I think you did a really good job of breaking that down and giving some concrete examples of what accountability looks like. And for coaches that are out there listening at whatever level, I think they can take what you just said and take it to heart and be able to go back to their team and really look at what they're doing and figure out how can I hold my kids accountable. And I think that the word that I pulled out of there is, you know, again, you're intentional about what you're doing. You're intentional about making sure that A, you're holding your team accountable, and then you're also teaching them how to hold each other accountable. And to me, that's what successful coaches do. And when you're able to hold kids accountable for what your expectations are, now you're starting to build that culture like you described. And you've mentioned that the next step for you is to get to the point where your kids can perform at their best on the biggest stages. So as you look forward with where your program is right now today and where you want to get, what are some of the things that you're going to try to do, you're going to try to implement that you're going to work with your kids on to ensure that in that next phase, they'll be able to perform at their best on the biggest stages. That's going to allow you guys to get to what I'm sure your goal is, to win, you know, the Division III national championship.
Yeah, Mike, I'm still learning. You know, we've done a lot over the last several years. I mean, we've been picked to win our league 4 or 5 years in a row. We've won it. We've advanced in the NCAA tournament 4 straight years. Been to 2 Final Fours. So my kids have performed on the grand stage really, really well, and I attribute that to a whole lot of things, including our culture. But, you know, one of them is the time we've spent. I have a great friend, Dr. Ron Garbo, works with our team, works with me, and we talk about that performance and the stress that comes as the season progresses and as you advance in that tournament. Like, the stakes get higher, the temperature rises, and everybody, every coach and every player has a breaking point or a point where they all of a sudden they're thinking, right? Or they're nervous, right? or yep. Whatever.
Right.
Or the biggest thing is they get to a certain point where they're afraid to lose. We've invested so much, we've come so far, and now we're in this moment. And now I'm shooting this free throw. I'm more fearful of missing it than I am intentional about making it. And so for us, having these conversations, talking about how pressure, you know, we use the term pressure is a privilege. You know, that if you're starting to feel stress and pressure, like, that means you're on a big stage. Like, that's how many people would love to be in your shoes making that shot? Like, you're privileged. Enjoy that. Be in the moment. Soak it up. And if you miss, you miss. If you lose, you lose. You know what? The sun's going to rise the next day, and, you know, your family's still going to be there. And, like, you know, put it in perspective. But so it's conversations. It's, you know, there's some breathing techniques that we've incorporated into our program. Things like yoga, we've incorporated a little bit. And so we're not afraid to try new things. You know, I think we're on the cutting edge in a lot of ways of some of the things that we do. You know, we use heart rate variability, and we've tracked these guys, and we use data and whatever. I mean, we're trying whatever we can to make sure that if we're fortunate enough to get back to the biggest stage, that they can go out there and just play free, play with confidence, play for the love of the game, and be absolutely have no fear about the consequences and the results. If we can do that and we lose, we lose.
It's amazing how important your mind is in your performance. And you think about that as an athlete, you think about it as a coach and how it impacts the kids that you're coaching. And I think sometimes, you know, we take it for granted. And obviously there's been a lot of things in the news with NBA players and mental illness. And just, you know, you think about the stress that a professional athlete is under, and you think about the stress that a college athlete is under, and then you put them on a big stage in front of people with things that, you know, arguably when you're playing in a Final Four game, you know, that's probably the most important thing that your kids have done in their mind. You know, if they love basketball, that's something that is really, really important to them. And, you know, you combine all those things, and with the funny way our mind works, I think the more mental training that we can give our kids, the more opportunities we can give them to be able to have, you know, simulated situations where they, you know, where they risk something and they fail or they succeed. You give them experience in doing that so that when the real thing comes along, you hope that they're ready and willing to be able to handle that. But the mind is an interesting organ that has a huge impact on how our kids perform.
Yeah, we did more visualization type training this year than we ever have, and I thought it was really helpful for us. So,
yeah, so give us an example of that. What's something that you guys did? So when you say you did more visualization, give us an example of something specific that you guys did that you tried to visualize that you felt had an impact for your kids.
Yeah. So, you know, like I have another friend who Dave Farrell is a former Army Ranger. And, you know, he's another guy that I lean on and talk about, you know, like, cause I think there's so many parallels between, you know, what our military does and sport. And, you know, we talked in depth about what that looks like because, you know, you might be going into training for a battle. Well, you can't simulate everything, right? Just like when you're going ready to play a game, you can't simulate everything that's going to happen. And you only have so much practice time. Like when you get to February, you can't practice for 2.5 hours, right?
Right.
Like physically, you're in a mode where you need to really scale back. But mentally, like you actually need to maybe scale up. How do you do that? And, you know, what we tried this year a little bit, and I think it worked. You know, I'd like to poll my players and see, you know, what they thought of. I think generally, you know, they thought it was really good. But we might actually go through a scenario where we sat around, eyes closed, and we had the players and the coaches literally talk through, you name the scenario. All right. Hey, there's, you know, 20 seconds left in the game. It's our ball. We're down one. Just like you would do the scenario at the end of your practice on the court, we just visualized it and talked about it. Like, okay, so who's taking it out? You know, all right, where's the point guard? Who's cutting where? Okay, all right, hey, all right, Joe, all right, great. All right, now what? How much time's on the clock? How do you know? Because I looked up. So like you're walking through this visualization. That last 20 seconds of the game might take us 20 minutes to get through.
Right. So are you leading that at least initially, or are the players leading that or how? Okay.
I did, but they did, you know, I say, okay, you five guys are on the court for this one.
Right.
Okay. All right. Tell me what's going to happen now. Okay. I say, well, hey, I'm going to catch this, you know, I'm being double teamed because we're up one, you know, I'm going to have to pivot. Fake, make a bounce pass to so-and-so who's cutting. I know he's cutting because we have this press break on, you know, and like going through every detail about the scenario that we can, which I found fascinating because there's so much to it, right?
Right, absolutely.
Just that 20 seconds that they do naturally, you watch the game, it's 20 seconds, but you talk about the details of those 20 seconds, it takes like 20 minutes.
Right.
And so you don't just cover that scenario. You're actually covering many scenarios because you could get trapped at any point during the game. So you've covered that. And so we did that for, you know, really several times over the last once the postseason hit. And I thought it was a great way for us to kind of walk through some of the things we wanted to cover without actually having to be on the court physically.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's something that it's definitely the direction that coaching and the game is headed in terms of A, the understanding of the physical toll that the season takes on players. And, you know, again, you go back 20 or 30 years ago and you were still practicing 2.5 hours the day before a game in February. And nowadays, you know, we have a much better understanding physiologically of what that does to the body. And then, as you described, you can do the same thing and mentally rehearse that and put those kids in the same scenario, but just not doing it and putting the wear and tear on their body. And they're still going through and they're thinking the game. And that's really, really, I think, underrated in terms of helping a kid develop a higher basketball IQ, and also just putting yourself in a situation where you're really thinking about it. Like, if we think back to the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned, you know, yourself that, you know, you got by on just out competing and outworking people when you were younger. And you probably didn't spend a whole lot of time thinking about the kinds of scenarios that you just described, spending 20 minutes thinking about 20 seconds of gameplay. And I'm sure you have players on your team that are similar to how you were in that, you know, they don't necessarily, either they're competitive or they just kind of have a natural feel for the game and they're not really stopping to think about it. And by putting them in position where they do have to stop and think about what they're going to do and visualize it, I can see where by doing that, if you're doing it throughout the season, A, they're going to get better at that visualization, and then B, that visualization is going to transfer when they do see that scenario ultimately in a game. So I think it's, again, it's interesting. I love learning about things like that where it's something that's new. It's something that's interesting. It's something that's exciting. And it's something where here you are trying to reach out and figure out any kind of edge, just thinking about you talking about watching film and how it's a jigsaw puzzle and you're trying to figure out how to give your kids an advantage. Here's one more way that you as a coach are trying to give your kids an advantage to put them in the best possible position to be able to be successful. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, you know, again, I think it comes down to your culture and the guys that you have and what you're comfortable with as a coach, right? Not all or even a lot of coaches would be comfortable doing that. And I certainly wasn't comfortable the first time.
Yeah, I believe it.
You know, and there's a lot of great coaches out there who they have no interest in it. It's like they just, this is what I'm comfortable with. This is the way we're going to do things, and we're just going to do it better than anybody else. And you can be very successful that way. And, you know, we've had some success here and had some, you know, getting out of our comfort zone. You know, like our culture and our guys understand now, hey, listen, we're going to try a bunch of stuff. Like, and we're not going to be afraid to try some things. It's not always going to work, but we're going to learn from it. And then that hopefully is going to help us be better down the road, you know, and it's not flippant. You know, it's not like, oh, let's just try this thing because I saw on the news last night. You know,
right,
like it's
right.
We're going to educate ourselves and we're going to really try to find some areas where we can gain an advantage. And then we might try some things. And our team, our guys have bought in and it's been awesome because, you know, you run the risk if you try some things consistently and they don't work and you're losing games.
Right. Credibility, you know, credibility goes out the window fast.
Now you're a nut job, you know, and, or, you know, if you're in the very beginnings of your program and you're trying to do this stuff, they might look at you like,
who is this guy?
So, you know, again, I think it's all been the development of our program, the evolution, the maturity of our players, their growth and development that we're very lucky. I feel so lucky to be at a point where we can try some things. And again, they're very intentional. They're very educated. But the guys understand, hey, let's try this. It's not going to be the end of the world. Let's learn from it. And if it can help us, you know, by all means, you know, let's get out of our comfort zone. So that's been really cool. And I know we've talked for quite some time, man. I could talk about this stuff all day long.
I love it. I really do. I mean, I think that there's so much out there now. There's so many interesting things that you can do, that you can try, that you can learn. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the leadership piece and the growth mindset and all this stuff. And, you know, I think there's always something out there that you can learn, that you can try to see if it can make you personally better as a leader or as a coach, and if it can make your team better and lead to more success out on the court. And, you know, again, some things work for some people and, you know, they may not work for everybody, but I think the fact that you're out there and you're willing to try, to me, that's really cool. And I really got to have a lot of respect for the fact that you're trying some outside the box things to help give your kids an advantage. I want to wrap up with one last question. It's kind of a broad question, but we'll see if we can kind of package it down. And can you talk a little bit about where you are now in terms of what your recruiting process looks like? So a little bit of maybe from start to finish, just kind of give us a brief synopsis for maybe parents who are out there listening or high school coaches, just to kind of give them an understanding of what it looks like, your recruiting process, kind of from beginning to end, how you first identify a kid and then what the process looks like until they, you know, they show up on campus as a freshman.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had great assistant coaches, and I'm also at Christopher Newport University, which is a world-class institution. You know, so our incoming class this year as an institution will be a 3.84 GPA, and over a 1200 SAT. So like we're attracting some really, really just bright young people to our school, and we have world-class facilities. So I'm very fortunate that I'm at a place that in a lot of ways sells itself and is attractive. Now, almost every one of our kids is from the state of Virginia. We are a state school. So for me, it's very important that we absolutely kill it in Virginia and that we take care of our home state. And so my assistant coaches, mostly during the junior year, will be getting names and talking to coaches, and we'll have team camps. And, you know, so by the spring of an athlete's junior year in high school, you know, we'll be paring our list down to who we think are maybe the, let's say, top 50 kids in the state that we believe fit in some way, you know, our program and our school, you know. And then we'll have that spring, those spring recruiting events in April of their junior year will really be the beginning where we start to narrow that list down. We'll invite some of those to campus in May and June. And we'll continue to narrow that list down, watch summer leagues and fall in June, and then the recruiting cycle in July. Some of those that we've targeted will play themselves into Division I scholarships, and some will play their way out of our recruiting list, but we'll then, you know, probably have a working list of not many. Heading into the fall here now, our list is, you know, I think pretty strong and not too big. So maybe 15 players on our list that are prioritized. And this September we'll have official visits and, you know, those that we've targeted, and we'll hope to recruit them hard. And depending on their time frame and making a decision, then we'll do some more visits in October. I think we would hope to have by November two or three commitments, and then probably go through the season. And then at some point towards the end of our season in February, March, April, complete our class with two more. So probably a class of five this year. And, you know, that's kind of how it would break down for us at Division III at a state school in Virginia that's attractive. So that's right. That could be totally different.
Right.
Than a Division I school, yep. Division II school, right. A Division
Everybody's
III
process.
School.
Yep.
Maybe one that recruits more nationally or regionally, or maybe doesn't have the academics or what, you know. So, but that's our niche, and it's been really good to us.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody's process in terms of the type of player that they're looking for is different depending on their institution and the level of play that they're at. And so I just wanted to get a feel for kind of what your process looks like. So thanks for sharing. There we go.
Man.
Man.
That's a sign. That's a sign.
You got squirrels over there or what? I like it. We're coming up on an hour and a half here, John. So I wanted to, first of all, just say thanks to you for coming on and spending the time with us. We really appreciate it. And before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share your contact information, how people can reach out to you. And then if there's any final point that you'd like to make, you can go ahead and do that as well. And then we'll wrap up the episode after you get a chance to do that.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the time that we've had. I love talking basketball. Probably the best way to reach me is via email. It's real simple, Coach K at cnu.edu. So simple enough. If I don't respond immediately, try me again. I guess I'm old school when it comes to my email. So I think my inbox is pretty full right now, but I will respond eventually. So keep trying me on my email at coachk@cnu.edu. And one of the things I love about being a head coach, and I do this with VCU with the grad students, is giving back to guys and girls that want to get into coaching, and young coaches, and try to have them, be able to and help them in some way on their journey. And I really enjoy doing that. So anyone that's in that boat, please reach out to me. I'll help in any way that I can.
Awesome. John, like I said, we can't thank you enough for jumping on with us tonight. It's been a pleasure. After we got a chance to interact and meet down at the Billis camp, we appreciate you taking the time to jump on with us. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.